Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. With major roads in Venezuela blocked by protesters, we will begin with the standoff between student protesters and the Maduro government. The author of Comandante, Hugo Chavez's Venezuela, Rory Carroll, who up until recently was the UK Guardian correspondent in Caracas, Venezuela, joins us to discuss growing opposition to an increasingly unpopular government and his article at The Guardian, Venezuela, Chaos and Thuggery Take the Place of the Pretty Revolution. Then we'll analyze Secretary of Defense Hagel's budget plans for 2015 that seeks to downsize the army but increase special forces and spend more on cyber warfare. Winslow Wheeler, a 31-year veteran of Pentagon procurement at the U.S. Senate and General Accounting Office, joins us to discuss Hagel's plans to keep most of the budget-busting weapons systems like the F-35 that is exorbitantly more expensive and less effective than the planes it is replacing, and the extent to which Hagel, who promised to fight waste, fraud and bloat, appears to have been captured by the pork barrel politics of the Pentagon. Then finally, we'll go to Mexico City for a follow-up on the capture of the drug lord El Chapo Guzman and speak with Dudley Althaus, the Global Post senior correspondent in Mexico. We will look into the possible role of U.S. special forces and intelligence agencies in the capture of Guzman and, while the cartel leader has been formally charged in Mexico, whether or not he will be extradited to the U.S. as top judicial officials in the U.S. are calling for. And joining us now is Rory Carroll, who up until recently was based in Caracas, Venezuela, as the UK Guardian and Observer Latin American correspondent. He is the author of Comandante, Hugo Chavez's Venezuela, and is currently the US West Coast correspondent for The Guardian. His latest article at The Guardian is Venezuela, Chaos and Thuggery Take the Place of the Pretty Revolution. Welcome to Background Briefing, Rory Carroll.
Hi, Ian. Thank you for having me.
And the revolution, the pretty revolution, La Revolución Bonita, that's a quote from Hugo Chavez. That's what he used to call the Bolivarian Revolution.
Yes. In his speeches, he would even sing about La Revolución Bonita, because for him, this signified all the good things in terms of progressive values, making Venezuela a beacon internationally for a better way to organize humanity's affairs. But on recent events now suggest otherwise.
Well, there is, of course, there has been up until a couple of days ago, the chaos in the Ukraine, particularly in Kiev, and in many squares around the world. It does seem that the town square is being recaptured as a kind of as a venue for protests in many countries, whether it's Spain, Greece, or Ukraine, or now Venezuela. So, how does this compare? Because there's been complaints from reporters I've spoken to down there about public security, about the high murder rate and the high inflation rate. But what is your sense of what's changed lately?
Yeah, I think in Venezuela, it's quite unique circumstances, and it's not really related to the coincidence that this has been happening the same time as protests in Ukraine and Thailand, for instance. Really, the protests are symptomatic of widespread grievances over the total dysfunction that we see in Venezuela, that after a decade of record oil revenues, I mean, Venezuela sits atop the world's biggest oil revenues, that all this money has gone into the country, and yet this kind of quasi-socialist, petro-populist system that Hugo Chavez bequeathed to his successor is completely dysfunctional. The economy is in chaos. Inflation is around 56% annually. There are chronic and severe shortages in basic goods like toilet paper, bread, cooking oil, flour. People often have not been paid or delays in wages. And also public security is frankly a nightmare. Venezuela is one of the highest per capita murder rates in the world. And these problems have been festering for years, but sort of come to a head recently, and with students, university students, taking a lead, saying they're fed up, and they want to achieve what they call la salida, which is the exit. In this case, the exit of the government.
But defenders of the government will point out that they won the elections against Capriles, not quite narrowly and unexpectedly so, because of the tremendous sympathy vote for the late leader Chavez. But then more recently, municipal elections went their way. So has something happened more in recent months, or is it just the culmination of a lot of frustration?
Well, the government is right that, I mean, Venezuela is not a dictatorship. It's a hybrid system. It's democratic, but also authoritarian. And so there are elections. They're not very fair. The government has lopsided advantages in the sense that it dominates and controls media, especially through kind of self-censorship. Because of the Petro state, it basically has all the money. And there's lots of intimidation, but there are you know, democratic institutions there. So the protests so far really have been done by a small, largely middle class minority. I mean, the most Venezuelans are poor, and they so far haven't really joined the protests. And for that reason, the government actually looks pretty solid, despite these scenes we're seeing of, you know, 13 people killed in the past week, and despite these kind of blockades and a lot of cocktails flying. The government is pretty solid in the sense that it controls all the key institutions, especially the army and the police, as well as the National Oil Company. And it still has a certain kind of bedrock of legitimacy among poor Venezuelans. And so I think the government certainly is not in any immediate danger of falling. And these latest protests are largely were the work of an opposition politician who kind of mobilized students or directed student protests into this kind of wider challenge to the government. And for the time being, I think the government pretty much is holding all the best cards.
So is this purely then a case of a class struggle in a country that's dominated by poor, that the government, if it has solid backing from the people who the Chavez revolution have most affected and whose lives have been most improved by it? I mean, how long before the basic dysfunction, which apparently is the case? I mean, that seems to be the real critique, is that the place is just a shambles. It's not working. And the government keeps blaming, outside forces, the CIA, the Americans, you name it, but doesn't seem to want to take responsibility for anything. But as long as it's just the face of the middle class, it would seem to me that this will be a kind of polarized and static situation, albeit one that's where the dysfunction continues. Is that the way you see it?
I mean, there's an inbuilt tension here, because even if the government prevails over these current protests, and I think they will, the huge systemic problems in the economy and the society, basically of a country that's unraveling at the seams, even though it still has lots of money, is going to remain a huge challenge to the government. And these problems are ever more encroaching on the poor, on the support base of the government. And there's sort of a Faustian pact which the government has with the poor Venezuelans, which is it provides a lot of people with government jobs, or at least government salaries, even if they're not necessarily doing any productive work. It provides lots of subsidies. For example, gasoline is basically free. It gives people free housing, or the promise of free housing, and other goodies. It also gives people free electrical goods. It sometimes orders stores to have their prices, at which point, of course, there's a stampede, especially from the slums into these stores to get these cheap goods. So the government can kind of shore up its kind of popularity and support with these measures, but they have a cost, because these same measures are what is basically hollowing out the economy and the institutions of the state. And gradually these problems are getting worse and worse and worse. And so there's plenty of signs that the poor are now beginning to get fed up, that the goodies that they're given by the government, which also includes social programs and anti-poverty programs, which in their heyday were terrific and very progressive, but they've also become victim of this kind of hollowing out of the country. And it looks increasingly that the poor are, I think, at some point could well join the middle class, not necessarily in the next few weeks or even months, but are, especially in the cities, in the urban areas, the poor are proving to be increasingly disenchanted with the Chavista government.
Again, I'm speaking with Rory Carroll, who up until recently was based in Caracas, Venezuela, as the UK Guardian and Observer Latin American correspondent. He is the author of Comandante Hugo Chavez's Venezuela and is currently the US West Coast correspondent for The Guardian. His latest article at The Guardian is Venezuela, Chaos and Thuggery Take the Place of the Pretty Revolution. Well, it would seem, though, that the economy has been incredibly mismanaged, though, in fundamental ways, because my understanding is that it's been Chinese money that's keeping this party afloat, but at the great expense of mortgaging all that oil in the ground. You say that it's an oil-rich country, so the money keeps pouring in, but it's not necessarily, in the long term, very sustainable if you've mortgaged what's under the ground. So is there any sense that Maduro government will have a dialogue? I mean, I can't imagine you can function in a country where you don't you've demonized the wealthy, and with good reason in terms of the history of an oligarchical rule up until he took over. But if you keep demonizing the middle class, it would seem to me that you know the country will become less and less productive. I mean. How much is class warfare a weapon that this government is using? Because, you know, recently the CNN crew got attacked, and the National Guardsman who saw it pointed out to them after they'd had their camera equipment confiscated that these guys were plainclothes police working for the government. So it does. There's a lot of evidence that the government itself is using thugs to intimidate and harass people whose politics they don't like and who don't support their politics.
Yes, I mean, when you look at, for example, the infrastructure, of the physical infrastructure of the country, you know, we see power cuts repeatedly. Roads and bridges are flaking. I mean, you take your life in your hands when you take a road trip across Venezuela. And industries, factories have been are often kind of rusting because they can no longer afford to import spare parts. Fields have, you know, and agriculture in many areas has withered, and there seems to be little sign of any changes or pragmatic adjustments in this kind of quasi, you know, socialist system in the future. Now, Hugo Chavez was able to kind of ride out these problems because when he was still in power and still alive, he was receiving far more money for his oil than his successor. And also Hugo Chavez had this capacity of distraction. He was a great showman. And he had also this this amazing connection with the poor that they really felt he was on their side, that even if, you know, their own lives in some ways were not necessarily getting better, but they felt that he was definitely their champion. And Nicolas Maduro doesn't have that same same flair for communication, and also he's running out of money, that he's having to borrow more billions from China, even though oil prices are still high, and that's why I think we've seen a degree of thuggishness from the state, which didn't really happen under Hugo Chavez, because Chavez was strong enough and confident enough that he didn't need to resort to these thuggish tactics, which we're now seeing in the past week, where hordes of motorbike gangs, a kind of paramilitary unit, basically known as colectivos, are a de facto extension of the state, and they roar around middle class neighborhoods, terrorizing people. But to be fair, I mean, some of the protesters have been using violent methods. We are seeing protesters attacking government property. They're throwing petrol bombs and rocks. And I mean, any state in the world would need to rein in these protesters. But Human Rights Watch and other advocacy groups have been saying that really the state response has been excessive. At least I think 10 of the 13 who have been killed have been killed by state security forces, or by, it appears, by thugs acting in the name of the government of Nicolas Maduro. And so the question now really is whether, you know, these protests will set an example for poor Venezuelans who have this often similar grievances to these middle class students. And the question is, well, will the poor join them? If not this week, maybe in a few months' time, or not, because Venezuela has a long history of these periodic explosions of social unrest. And so a lot of people were all just wondering and waiting to see, well, whether is this going to happen again.
But how much longer can a country just sort of stagnate and you've described this situation as Venezuela is a shambolic, crumbling, dysfunctional ruin. So if he's demonizing the business community and the middle class and shouting slogans and blaming everything on the CIA, the economy's not making any headway. So you either go the whole Cuban route or you make some kind of peace. I mean, that would seem to me to be the situation. Otherwise, it just seems to be the polarization will continue. I mean, it's not a sign of good governance when you do have a polarized country, frankly.
No, it's not good governance, but polarization is actually a sensible, rational policy if you're the government there, because by polarizing things and keeping the political temperature quite high, you oblige people to make a choice. And also you radicalize your opponents, who repeatedly have fallen into this trap of becoming very extreme, super shrill. They, especially the middle class or wealthy opposition leaders, screaming Stalinism and dictatorship to poor Venezuela, and they just look completely out of touch. And they're thinking, well, you know, if you have to choose between a government that provides subsidies and certain kind of social benefits versus very kind of rich oligarch type looking leaders in the opposition, the poor will side with the government. And this is a venerable strategy that Hugo Chavez very successfully used again and again, and I think Maduro hopes the same thing will happen. And also, I think in the current climate, the opposition, they don't want to sit down with the government because they feel this would legitimize the government in the eyes of their own supporters, would be seen as a betrayal. So unfortunately, although dialogue is what this country really needs, neither side really has incentive to go for it. And on your second point about the economy, despite the fact that Venezuela is a shambolic, crumbling system, it is not on the point of collapse. On the contrary, it's a petrostate, an oil state, and that every month is receiving billions of dollars that go directly into the coffers of the state, which has a very well-developed system of patronage and clientelism. And it uses these funds to shore up its own position. And so even though as things crumble around it, it can actually still control the levers, it controls the spigot of money and all the main institutions of state. It can afford to kind of buy or co-opt a lot of sectors in society. Now, this cannot go on forever and ever. It can certainly go on for a lot longer. As long as oil prices stay high, as long as oil prices stay at their current price of around $100 a barrel, this kind of shambolic system can basically kind of bumble on almost indefinitely.
So then how do you explain, Rory Carroll, the 56% inflation, the shortages of bread, flour, meat, toilet paper and other basics, the fact that airlines are threatening to cut services because the government owes them $3.3 billion, food companies are owed $2.4 billion. Does Maduro just do some kind of triage here? He just basically pays off who he needs to when all the oil money flows in, as it does, apparently, on an endless basis. Although, as I mentioned, you know, there's a price you pay when you have to borrow because you mortgage what's in the ground.
Yes, but I think you could do some triage, and what he could do and what he may do is do some kind of pragmatic concessions to economic sanity, which would be, for instance, devaluing, like a formal and big devaluation of the currency, which is artificially and hugely overvalued, and this completely basically destroys distorts the economy. Now, to devalue the currency, it would be very painful in the short term, especially for the poor. But at some point, if he feels strong enough, if the government can manage to do that and get away with it, that will reduce some of this irrationality in the economy. And similarly, if they have the wit or the political strength to reduce some of the more insane subsidies, for instance, literally giving away gasoline for free to everybody, if they can begin to maybe increase the price of gasoline, which is a politically potentially explosive decision, but if they can if they can be, you know, clever and engaging in the way they can impose a little bit of sanity there, then that can keep the show on the roads a lot longer. Now, but the issue is a big question mark over whether President Maduro really does have the wit to do that, because so far, in the 10 months since he succeeded Hugo Chavez, he's tread water. He's not taking the initiative to address any of these huge imbalances that are completely warping his own economy. So the future of the government and Chavismo depends on the ability of the government to make some of these, you know, concessions to reality. And you know, if they do, then I think they can survive, a lot longer.
So, is there any fissures within the military? I know there was some. Angel Vivas is sitting on his rooftop with a flak jacket and an assault rifle. I believe they call him Rambo, but he apparently objected to the oath, the Cuban inspired oath that the military have to swear to, which is fatherland, socialism, or death. So, is there any, given that Chavez came up in a military coup and came out of the military? Is there any, and we know that Cuba, of course, is very invested in this country because it essentially saves their economy by giving them oil subsidies once the Soviets cut them off, or the Russians. So is there any fissures in that department, given everything else that we've talked about? That would be Maduro's and the Chavistas' strength. Is it the military? I mean...
Yes, if there was to be a coup in Venezuela, it would depend on the military. Without the military, there would be, you know, a coup. And personally, I hope that there would not be a coup, because Venezuela has seen that movie too many times, and it doesn't. It never ends well. I think anecdotally, and it's my own reporting when I was in Caracas, yes, there are elements, especially mid-ranking officers in the military, who are not happy with the government. They feel especially... the fact that Cubans have been given the run of the government and of the state in many ways is offensive to many Venezuelan military officers. But the government and the revolution has been running Venezuela for 15 years now, and many times they've kind of swept out the officers that they feel would be that are not with the program. And so I think certainly the top ranks, the generals, the admirals, and the colonels. Appear to be very loyal to the government. Below that, on these other major, the captains and the majors, there may be a question mark over their loyalty. But I think that they would not be senior enough to stage a coup of their own. So that I think really the government is safe for the time being from a military coup.
Well, Rory Carroll, I thank you very much for joining us.
It was a pleasure, Ian. Thank you for having me.
Again, I've been speaking with Rory Carroll, who up until recently was based in Caracas, Venezuela, as the UK Guardian and Observer Latin American correspondent. He's the author of Comandante Hugo Chavez's Venezuela, and is currently the US West Coast correspondent for The Guardian. His latest article at The Guardian is Venezuela, Chaos and Thuggery Take the Place of the Pretty Revolution. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back looking into whether Chuck Hagel, who promised to get rid of bloat, has been captured by the Pentagon's pork barrel politics.
Una potra la sana, caballo viejo se encuentra, el pecho se le desgrana y no le hace caso a falseta, y no le obedece a freno ni lo paran falsas riendas. We'll be right back.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Winslow Wheeler, who has worked on national security issues for 31 years for members of the U.S. Senate and for the U.S. General Accounting Office. In 2002, Winslow authored an essay under the pseudonym Spartacus about Congress's reaction to the September 11th terrorist attacks, which led senators to ask for his resignation from the Republican staff of the Senate Budget Committee. He is now a senior fellow and director of the Strauss Military Reform Project at the Project on Government Oversight, and is the author of Wastrels of Defense, How Congress Sabotages U.S. Security. Welcome to Background Briefing, Winslow Wheeler.
Thanks very much, Ian. I appreciate it.
And Pentagon's Secretary of Defense Chuck Hagel's plans to downsize the U.S. military was unveiled. Particularly, the Army is getting a lot of publicity because it says it's going to be the smallest army since before World War II. But isn't the Army already changing into a focus on special forces? And in fact, that's true of all of the Marines as well, isn't it?
Well, yes. And the rhetoric that the Army is going to be smaller than it was before Pearl Harbor in this country is a bunch of hooey, to keep it radioable. The Navy is currently smaller than it was before World War One. The Air Force is much smaller than it ever was since the end of World War II. That's all meaningless rhetoric. They're trying to generate more money and creating some level of concern, if not hysteria, in the public as they pound the table for more money.
Well, aren't they also, though, wasting all of this money? I know 60 Minutes did a piece on the F-35, and we've talked about it over the years because it is the single biggest defense procurement project in world history. And it's a complete turkey. Aren't they in a situation now where they're running out of A-10s, which have served the country very well, and F-16s and F-18s, they're thinking about extending the line on them? Are we in a situation where the new stuff we're buying is worse than the old stuff that we're retiring?
Well, yes. I mean, to go back to the start of your question and to quickly answer, the 60 Minutes piece on the F-35 barely scratched the surface. Our existing inventory of airplanes is indeed extremely old. We can certainly extend their lifetime for another 10, 20 years, and we'll have very good airplanes by doing that. The F-35 is a step backwards, but getting it on performance, but getting it back to your basic point, here we are with a airplane, the F-35, that replaces the A-10, for example, at a cost that is about eight times the cost of an A-10. And we're getting a airplane for that that can't perform the mission that the A-10 performs. So it's really a microcosm of our budget problems. We're paying more and we're getting less.
But aren't we using the A-10 in Afghanistan, and hasn't it proven? I mean, I'm not suggesting, that I'm not picking weapon systems here because I'm not an expert on it. But my understanding is that that's something we're actually using, as opposed to this other thing that doesn't do anything well, the F-35, and that this whole stealth thing has turned out to be a huge scam because the Russians have the ability to detect them. So they built this stupid plane that's supposed to do everything for everybody and does nothing particularly well for anybody.
Well, you said it very well. And it does that poor performance across the spectrum of missions at huge cost, both to buy it and to maintain it. It's also a step backwards on maintenance costs. They always advertise these things as being a bargain on maintenance compared to existing airplanes. The cost per flying hour, for example, of the F-35 is going to be two or three times the cost of some of the airplanes it's replacing. It's really a problem. And going back to the Hagel budget for 2015, he is going to take some tiny little nicks out of the program, and otherwise it's full speed ahead. The problem is the plane can't go very fast ahead in an acquisition sense because it's having so many problems in its testing. that delays are inevitable. But, of course, the right thing to do would be to cancel the program and replace it with competent designs of affordable and effective airplanes.
So, again, I'm speaking with Winslow Wheeler, who has worked on national security issues for 31 years as for members of the U.S. Senate and for the U.S. General Accounting Office. In 2002, he authored an essay under the pseudonym Spartacus about Congress's reaction to the September 11th terrorist attacks, which led senators to ask for his resignation from the Republican staff of the Senate Budget Committee. And he's now a senior fellow and director of the Strauss Military Reform Project at the Project on Government Oversight, and is the author of The Wastrels of Defense, How Congress Sabotages U.S. Security. So back to the headline of the idea that we're going to have the smallest army since before World War II. Isn't the army already heading in that direction of adding to special forces? They're also putting extra money into cyber warfare. Hasn't Afghanistan and Iraq taught us something about how boots on the ground end up being more, you know, like a magnet for trouble, that you don't really need a big footprint anymore?
Well, but in their own hearts, they're not cutting back the army because they want to avoid these kinds of commitments in the future. They'd be happy to run around the world doing these sorts of things. They have not learned their lesson. They're doing it because somebody has got to pay the bill for the expansion of complex, expensive hardware that the Air Force and the Navy want to acquire based on the so-called pivot towards Asia, where land forces are de minimis and long-range air forces and naval forces are on the budgetary upswing. And so it's not deep strategic thinking that's going into this downsizing of the Army. It's a budget fight, and the Army is losing.
So who's winning?
The Air Force and the Navy.
But the Air Force are the ones that are behind. They've got drones, but they've also got this F-35. They put all their eggs in that turkey basket, right?
Well, they're going to spend a huge amount on it. They also have super ambitious, visions of continuing to buy $11, $12 billion aircraft carriers, $1 billion destroyers, and so on. The Army only recently canceled a program for a personnel carrier that weighs 70 tons, more, almost as much as the tank. The point being that their acquisition plans for the future are still totally out of control. There's been some decisions to take down some of the lower-hanging fruit of these programs, but in a basic sense, it's full speed ahead with the high-cost, highly complex kinds of weapon systems that the F-35 is the embodiment of.
Well, my understanding is that this huge behemoth that they built, the armored personnel carrier called the MRAP, they can't even get the damn things out of Afghanistan because they're so heavy.
Well, I was talking about the replacement, the ground combat vehicle.
Exactly. That's the replacement. But the current ones that have saved a lot of troops' lives, they're cutting them up for scrap metal because they're too heavy to get out of the theater in Afghanistan.
Well, they can get them out of the theater if they wanted to. It's just expensive and inconvenient to them. The services don't want those vehicles. They didn't want them in the first place. And having all those 20,000 MRAPs lying around will get in the way of the plans for the new vehicle. And so, again, mass behind the, frontage of a strategic decision is basically a budgetary decision.
Well, that's putting it politely, Winslow Wheeler. I mean, you say it's a budgetary decision. It's a raid on the Treasury, isn't it? If you've got perfectly workable weapon systems like the MRAP and they're too inconvenient to get out of Afghanistan, so you just cut them up for scrap metal because you want to get a new, more expensive toy that may not even be as good as the old toy.
Right, and the raid in the Treasury is quite large. They're protesting that there's a shortage of money. There's no such thing. We're spending under the new 2015 level at a level of spending inflation-adjusted dollars of about our 2005-2006 budget. That level is scores of billions above what we spent on average during the Cold War in inflation-adjusted dollars. Our problem is not a shortage of money. Our problem is how we're profligately wasting the money that we have.
So what can you say about Hegel then? Is it just that, you know, the system just captures anybody that goes into that building, the Pentagon?
Sure as hell captured him. Before his nomination, he talked about the Pentagon budget being voted and the need to get it under control. And he has changed his tune 180 degrees. The word bloat has not passed his lips since he was nominated, and he's helping the Joint Chiefs of Staff stuff more money into the budget plan. A good example is the $26 billion so-called Opportunity Fund that they're going to dangle in front of Congress if they fund it, and they're going to go to any degree of lengths to get Congress to fund it.
Opportunity for what? What does that mean?
To buy more stuff. And the way they're going to game it is they're going to put their goodies in the basic budget for Congress to approve, and they're going to put funding for things like training and readiness in the so-called Opportunity Fund so Congress has little choice. It's a really cynical budget game.
So then what about this overall picture, though, of that there aren't any real chances of big wars anymore, big land wars?
We don't know what the future holds. We have a perfect track record of predicting every future war precisely wrong. We need to plan for uncertainty, and those who say, oh, we don't need an army, or those who say, oh, we have to have special forces, they're just following, you know, today's trendy fad of what the wonks are saying these days. In point of fact, in the past, when we have gone for buying these kinds of complex air and naval systems, we found them to be quite useless in the kinds of wars we've ended up fighting. So we need to be very careful.
Right, but if you look at all the wars that we've fought since the end of the Cold War, I mean, it's pathetic. It's a joke. Panama, a tiny little country that the U.S. has occupied forever. Iraq, twice. You know, and now that's a devastated country. Afghanistan, one of the poorest nations on the planet, and everybody that's gone into that swamp has been sucked into a quagmire. And, you know, what's the other one? North Korea, that's the big threat. A pathetic, failed state. It's true, it maybe has 5 or 6 or maybe 10 nuclear weapons, but that's more, you know, it's more dangerous to have a war with that place than not to have a war with it. You know, it's so crazy.
Well,
are we going to go to war with China?
You're making a basic point. The size of your budget is no guarantor of who wins in the fight. Unfortunately, our huge budget has produced a rather feeble, fat and lazy dog. You know, we had every possible advantage over the Vietnamese, the Viet Cong, and the North Vietnamese in that war, and we lost it. We were told to leave by the Iraqis with our tail between our legs and look at the mess we left behind us. And the same thing is about to happen, a few variations on the theme, in Afghanistan. We have expended huge human and material treasure in these adventures, and look what we've gotten for it.
But I was suggesting, Winslow Wheeler, that, you know, does anybody seriously think we're going to go to war with Russia or China? I mean, you know.
We'll take an act of unimaginable incompetence to do that, but the purpose for China and Russia to these people is to justify more spending, and that's precisely what they're doing.
I see. So it's what Rumsfeld said about why he wanted to go to war in Iraq and why he was unhappy with Afghanistan was because there weren't any good targets in Afghanistan.
Well, it demonstrates how clueless that man was.
Right. Well, just in closing, Winslow Wheeler, you know, is there any way that any sanity can prevail? I mean, it just feels like a shell game where they keep talking about, you know, we're going to hell in a handbasket, and you've just pointed out we're spending more than ever in real dollars. Our threats have all but disappeared, and we just got through saying you'd have to be, and we're not going to go to war against China or Russia, but we're going to pretend that we need to be ready for that. And the best threat we can come up with is North Korea, and yet we have to spend more than we ever did at the height of the Cold War. I just wish that there was a national debate going on that reflected reality here.
Well, we do need a national debate about it. Unfortunately, it's both Democrats and Republicans who are alternatively doing nothing about it or trying to make it worse, both parties. And we need to educate ourselves about what's been going on and start reflecting our conclusions in how we behave in the political system in this country.
Well, Winslow Wheeler, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
It's my honor. Thank you very much.
Again, I've been speaking with Winslow Wheeler, who has worked on national security issues for 31 years for members of the U.S. Senate and for the U.S. General Accounting Office. In 2002, Wheeler authored an essay under the pseudonym Spartacus about Congress's reaction to the September 11th terrorist attacks, which led senators to ask for his resignation from the Republican staff of the Senate Budget Committee. He is now a senior fellow and director of the Strauss Military Reform Project at the Project on Government Oversight and is the author of The Wastrels of Defense, How Congress Sabotages U.S. Security. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll go to Mexico City for an update on whether or not the drug lord just captured will be extradited to the United States. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now from Mexico City is Dudley Althaus, who is the Global Post senior correspondent for Mexico and Central America, based in Mexico City. He has covered everything from drug war mayhem and political intrigue to environmental threats and energy industry investment. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dudley Althaus.
Thank you, Ian.
And what's the latest follow-up on the capture of the drug kingpin El Chapo Guzman? There are now talk here in the United States from senior Justice Department officials that they'd like to extradite him to the United States. But my understanding is he's been formally charged in Mexico.
He has been formally charged here with a 2009 cocaine trafficking charge. His lawyers have also filed an injunction or filed to block his extradition to the United States. He may or may not be extradited eventually to the United States, but it's going to take a while.
So the fact that it would take a while it means that that's an advantage to him, because can't they string out these things for years or months?
Yes, they certainly can. And I think what's more in play is that the Mexican government has to determine what's best for the best way to proceed on this. Certainly there's concern that he could indeed escape again from a prison. I think that concern is slight. But there's also concern that he could continue running his operations from inside the prison. That's happened before with the former head of the Gulf cartel, was jailed in 2003 and ran his operations from a federal prison pretty much until he was extradited to the United States in January of 2007.
Does this mean, though, that the president of Mexico, Enrique Peña Nieto, it's a bitter pill for him to swallow to admit that his country's system of jails, for example, are porous, and you would think that there's, with the national pride, or at least the pride that he apparently has of having caught this guy, that the idea that they have to hand him over to the Americans is an admission that things aren't so good with the Mexico's judicial system.
I think that's exactly right. Peña Nieto has sharply curbed the policy of his predecessor, Felipe Calderón, in extraditing gangsters to the United States. And I think it's for exactly what you pointed out. I mean, there is a matter of pride here. There's a matter of not being seen as submissive to the Americans. And so I think the interest would be to try and jail him here and keep him in jail here and to hold the trials here. He's also have time left to serve on the sentence that he escaped from back in 2001, and I would presume he has to serve that sentence first before he's extradited to the United States, apart from any other new trial and new conviction.
But you mentioned the other drug lord that was operating from a federal prison and kept running his cartel. That, I imagine, leads one to assume that El Chapo Guzman does not want to come to the United States.
Does not want to come to the United States. His lawyers today, in fact, have filed an injunction. They've filed papers to stop an extradition to the United States should that extradition be requested from the United States formally and received by the Mexican government. So definitely he does not want to be extradited.
So what is then the likely outcome of this trial? I mean, how long do you think it could go on for, and what kind of maximum security prisons do they have, short of the one that the other Gulf drug lord was in, where he was able to run his business from it?
Well, they have very good prisons, but I mean, I think that, you know, these guys have a lot of money, and sometimes these prisons are pretty easy to get your way in if you have a lot of money. Even the maximum security prisons, from what I understand. So as far as the trial, I mean, it could take months or even years. I mean, Chapo Guzman's going to have some very good lawyers, and there are a lot of ways to get around this. There'd be a lot of appeals and a lot of different strategies going on. I think it'll take quite a while. I don't think we'll see him coming to the United States anytime soon. That said, I mean, some things can be shortcutted if the Mexican government decides that extradition is really in their best interest to get him out of the country and put him into the gringos' hands. One analyst I talked to today thought that maybe that's not going to happen because he knows an awful lot about the workings of both the underworld in Mexico and the interaction between the underworld and Mexican officials. As the source said today, he said, you know, he would be the best informant in years and years coming out of Mexico for the Americans.
Again, I'm speaking with Dudley Althaus, who is the Global Post senior correspondent for Mexico and Central America, based in Mexico City. He has covered everything from drug war mayhem and political intrigue to environmental threats and energy industry investment. Well, that gets to I think, a point that we keep overlooking here in the United States, and that extent to which over 70,000 people have died in these drug wars in Mexico. Immaculately, when the drugs cross the border into the United States, we act as if there's no organized crime over here. And clearly, we are the market, and it's our money from our drug consumers that fuels this whole industry. What do you think we could learn from what happens on this side of the border in terms of the people that are bought off by drug lords? Because presumably, as much as they buy off officials in Mexico, they very likely buy off officials here in the United States, don't they?
Well, I would think so. I mean, I think there's corruption definitely in the United States. What officials and what analysts have said in the past is that the corruption is lessened because it becomes more dispersed in the United States. In Mexico, they're moving ton loads of cocaine or marijuana or, you know, lesser loads of methamphetamine, but serious loads of all kinds of drugs, which requires all kinds of corruption to ease the way to the border. And then at the border, they get split up. So it becomes more diverse. But I'm certain that there's corruption in the United States as well. And there have been some arrests and convictions of Border Patrol agents and customs agents and all the rest of it, and sheriffs throughout the United States. But having said that, I don't know if the corruption is the same as in Mexico, I mean, in the United States as it is in Mexico. I haven't covered the United States in quite a while, so I'm a little bit ignorant of that.
So, Dudley Altas, what do you know about the possibility then of U.S. involvement in this? Most of the credit has gone to the Mexican Marines, and apparently it's certainly due to them. But obviously there was some help with intelligence, with intercepts, et cetera. What's your understanding of the extent to which the U.S. was involved in either the intelligence that led to El Chapo Guzman's capture, or was there any, boots on the ground involvement?
I think there are probably agents on the ground, although everybody's being kind of coy about that. There have been different reports that there were indeed agents on the ground. There was definitely intelligence help from the Americans, telephone intercepts, wire intercepts, triangulation of telephone calls and his cell phones and that sort of thing. That comes from all angles. The Mexican Interior Minister just said today, this afternoon, that this was a Mexican operation with the gringos only, the Americans only being involved with support of technical support and intelligence support. That said, the Mexican Marines, and especially a very small unit of Mexican Naval Special Forces, the Mexican equivalent of the U.S. SEALs, if you will, have been involved since at least 2009 in spearheading the attacks against major drug capitals, major gangster targets for the Mexican government. And they have been the go-to units preferred by the U.S. Embassy and by Washington. That was supposed to be dialed back under Peña Nieto, but it seems like that's still going on.
So what exactly is the interaction then between the U.S. Special Forces, SEALs, et cetera, and this elite team? You say through the U.S. Embassy there's coordination?
Well, back during the Calderon administration, the embassy worked closely with the Mexican Navy, with the Mexican naval infantry, but especially their very small 400-man unit of specially trained special forces, Navy special forces. The U.S. government would feed information to the Navy special forces, which would then try to launch operations and capture or kill particular gangsters. The first time we've heard about that was in the December 2009 killing by Mexican Marines of drug lord Arturo Beltran Leyva. But it came out later in dispatches from the U.S. Embassy to Washington that were leaked by WikiLeaks that there was a close cooperation between the U.S. government and particularly the Mexican Navy. The government preferred that. The U.S. Embassy preferred that because you kept the information more secure. If you go down through the chains of command in many of these Mexican security forces, the chance of the information being leaked to the gangsters or the gangsters being warned of a pending operation are much higher.
But in terms of coordination, are there U.S. Officials down there or special forces people or military attachés that are actively working with this elite unit that's the equivalent of our Navy SEALs?
I'm not clear how it's gone over Peña Nieto, but certainly under the Calderon administration, which ended in December of 2012, there were direct and very close cooperation. The U.S. military attaché in the later years of the Calderon administration was, in fact, a Navy SEAL admiral, and he was replaced last year by a two-star general who's also a Special Forces, U.S. Special Forces general. So I think that it indicates that there's a direct and very close cooperation.
So
military attachés and embassies are usually of the rank of colonel or less and usually deal with like things like arms transfers and other lower-level interactions. To have flag officers and special forces flag officers here at the embassy was fairly unusual.
And are they still there?
As far as I know, the general is still here, yes.
So, these units then, this 400-man unit that it seems to be the tip of the spear here in terms of the Mexican Marines, they obviously have been carefully vetted and recruited. I remember reading a while back that I think it was the Mexico City Police Department was so corrupt that they were able to figure out who was on the take, because a lot of the police officers didn't even bother to pick up their paychecks.
I guess I don't remember that, but I don't doubt that story. The Mexico City police actually are considered better trained and less corrupt than others in the country, but certainly it's a problem throughout the country. Police in general are poorly paid and poorly treated in many places, not so much in Mexico City, but and easily susceptible to corruption on the part of the gangsters. Those who aren't corrupt are easily subdued by better armed gangsters here.
So if you've got these elite units, that doesn't necessarily translate, certainly doesn't translate to the rest of the police forces, and they're still in and around Acapulco, et cetera. It's still pretty much the Wild West. An American recently disappeared there, didn't he? He was traveling on a kind of an adventurer. So you get the impression that at the state level, there is something of the Wild West going on.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, there's definitely something of the Wild West going on. You mentioned the American that just disappeared in Michoacán State. We're not sure what exactly happened to this guy, but Michoacán is definitely the Wild West. It's lawless in many places. Police and prosecutors, the problem in Mexico is police aren't policing and prosecutors aren't prosecuting. And so there's this widespread impunity throughout Mexico, which is something that they have to confront. Unless Mexico wants to see the emergence of another El Chapo a few years down the road, the system itself has to be changed. Are these guys, the gangsters, just their names change and the circumstances change a little bit, but the story keeps going on and on.
So just in closing then, Dudley Altessa, presumably this same problem would exist within the prison system and within the judicial system itself, right?
It definitely exists within the prison system and judicial system. I mean, in recent years, there's been a number of prison riots in which jailers and even wardens have been implicated. There was a case not too long ago in the state of Durango where the warden was actually allowing gangsters aligned with a group aligned with El Chapo Guzman to get out of jail every night and go kill their enemies in the neighboring city and then return to jail by dawn and serve their sentence. Throughout northern Mexico, there's been quite a few prison riots in which jailers and wardens have been involved in allowing one group to massacre the others. Chapo himself got out of prison in 2001. He slipped out of prison, maximum security prison, supposedly in a laundry truck, but other people say he slipped out dressed as a prison guard. Mm-hmm. This has been a major problem and continues to be a major problem in Mexico, which might be a good argument for extraditing to the United States. We'll just have to see how the Peña administration balances the risk and benefits of extraditing him to the United States.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Dudley Althaus.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Dudley Althaus, who's a Global Post senior correspondent for Mexico and Central America based in Mexico City. He has covered everything from drug war mayhem and political intrigue to environmental threats and energy industry investment. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back looking into whether Chuck Hagel, who promised to get rid of bloat, has been captured by the Pentagon's pork barrel politics. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll go to Mexico City for an update on whether or not the drug lord just captured will be extradited to the United States. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program's available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.